in a sense, what I want to talk about today is, by illustrating through some of the projects, what makes cities valuable. I'm going to talk a little bit about this idea of the smart city, because it's a phrase that we hear quite a lot these days, but I find it a flawed paradigm. And I want to sort of basically outline an alternative structure of participation for the design of our cities over the near future, one which is actually more about structuring engagement and actually encouraging engagement and thinking about how you evaluate that rather than smartness as such. Just to sort of give a bit of sort of background here, this was an image I discovered in a book around about 1991 or 92, in my second or third year of architecture school. It's from a book called Boundary Layer Climate. So it's actually taken from a book, he took it, T.R. Oak took it from a book called The Climate Physiology of the Pig. And it's a picture of the same piglets in the same box, but on the right-hand side, the temperature has been increased by a few degrees. And so this kind of change in what you might think of as the program of the space has kind of quite dramatically altered the occupants' relationship to each other and the physical structure. And this actually was the thing that, for me, captured my imagination about what it was that I was interested in architecture. This idea not of the physical floors, walls, doors, you know, roof, these kinds of things, but all the stuff in between, the sound, the light, the temperature, the smell, the electromagnetic fields, the social relationships, all of these kinds of things that go together to inform our experience of space, what you might even think of as the software rather than the hardware. And so just, you know, this is the kind of trajectory that I'm on, of thinking about architecture in the city through this lens of the things that happen rather than the sort of the physical material in the buildings and what have you. So if you think about the city in that way, then you don't think about the city as a collection of buildings. You think of the city perhaps as a kind of a collection of accretions of different interactions over time, of conversations, of people meeting each other on the street and being confronted by ideas they haven't encountered before. You might think of these sorts of this kind of layering of familiarity and novelty and serendipity, if you like. And I think it sort of helps you think about the city then, again, not in terms of its physicality, but as a kind of an engine for heterogeneity. And in the context of all the kinds of engines that we humans have built over the centuries, the city is the one engine that actually supports diversity, that actually thrives and is sustainable because of novel inputs, if you see what I mean. Every other engine that we've ever built needs a particular form of input to have a particular form of output. You know, to put it bluntly, a thing like an engine in a car, you pour in petrol and you get movement. If you pour in something that's not petrol, then you don't get anything out the other end. But a city actually thrives on this idea of constantly being renewed through diverse and unexpected inputs. And so I would actually argue that the thing that makes cities valuable is their capacity to engender, encourage, and kind of produce the same kind of diversity that they thrive on as well. And to be these kinds of locations where we are confronted by complex ideas and challenged by things that maybe we don't even agree with. And if you think about it, this is a sort of quite a bit of a contrast to the rural context where you're less likely to be challenged by ideas and people and novelty that you are not expecting. The reason that this is important is because really what makes a city valuable, I would argue, is what in systems theory is known as a mess. Now, in systems theory, a mess, it doesn't refer to being dirty or disordered. It's about the idea of a system where you don't know the constituent parts. You can't label all of the nodes in a network. You don't know what the relationships between things are. You don't even know the boundaries of problems. That's what in systems theory is known as a mess. And in a sense, that's actually what makes the city valuable. that messiness, that sort of capacity to encourage and thrive on messy inputs, if you like. And the reason that this is important to kind of, for me to kind of focus on, is that actually, when you start thinking about the technological tools that are being used to run our cities, and when you think about the fact that actually a mess is not something you solve, it's only something that you manage. Because there's no point at which suddenly the city is solved. There's no point at which you can say, okay, done, I've fixed traffic, now on to population. Or I've done air quality, I can move on to the next problem. That just doesn't work in a city. Everything interacts with everything else. It's known as, again, in systems theory, you talk about wicked problems or super wicked problems. Things where actually not only do you not know the boundaries of the problem, sometimes the people who are working on the solutions for the problems are the ones that are actually creating the problem in the first place. That's what's known as a super wicked problem. So you manage a mess, you don't solve it. But all of the technology companies, the sort of large technology companies, the sort of the IBMs and Ciscos of the world that are increasingly getting into urban technology, their entire business model, and most IT companies' business model, is geared towards selling solutions. Their entire strategy is saying, you have a problem, here's my widget that will fix it. And so these kinds of companies tend to think of the city as a problem to be solved. And so they come and present a vision for the city that is all about security and convenience and efficiency and optimization, and you know, you'll get to work on time and you'll have a good shopping experience and you'll be safe walking down the street because of the cameras. And essentially what they're proposing is a way of ironing out all the wrinkles in the city that actually make it interesting and diverse and unexpected and messy in the first place. And the reason that this is problematic for me is that on the one hand, actually, things like a rapid transport system or safety on the streets are not actually technologically solved, right? We had an efficient transportation system, and there is an efficient transportation system in Tokyo, for example, and has been for decades. They're not waiting for some efficiency algorithm computer to solve that problem. It's a sociocultural phenomenon. It's tied into so many different things. It's not going to be solved simply by the right technology being input. But the other reason that it's really problematic for me is that all of this language about, you know, efficiency and convenience and predictability and optimization and all that is exactly the same language that was used in the 1950s and the 1960s to market high-rises and motorways, right? They talked about how we're going to connect up everything, make it more efficient, make cities more efficient, etc., etc. Now we understand the enormous social and environmental costs that both of these things have had. In New York City, which has been carved up by highways, splitting apart neighborhoods that had historically grown up together, and creating health consequences, you know, the closer you are to one of these highways, the higher the incidence of asthma, respiratory disease, etc., not to mention all of the cost that kind of comes out of this. So with the introduction of these sorts of technologies for efficiency and optimization and all these sorts of things, time and time again, we see that they have these untold consequences that actually are more expensive than a lot of the things that we are trying to deal with in the first place. And actually, often when you look at the decision making behind this idea of building a smart city and all the technology you need to control the city, you find that actually what's going on is this desire for managers of things to be able to say, I didn't make the decision, the technology did, right? To abdicate a sense of responsibility to a technological tool that basically says, it wasn't me, it was the data, you know, it was the algorithm that decided that. And this kind of progressive, if you like, sort of use of technology as an excuse for making decisions is coupled with an increasing distrust or mistrust in our own capacity to make decisions as well. You know, so often right now, people start to think, oh, you know, I can't keep track of my schedule, I'm going to just offload it to the calendar, which is fine, but I think we need to be bearing in mind the aggregated consequences of all of these decisions to amplify what we're doing when we are actually sort of undercutting the things that we do quite well, which is to manage complexity. You know, one of the most beautiful things about human beings is their capacity to deal with complexity and find ways around it. And so I'm not going to be proposing a sort of an anti-technological angle here, because this is not about, oh, technology is bad. It's about saying, actually, there are many ways that we can use technology, and technology is as much a piece of physical hardware as it is a kind of sociocultural phenomenon. There are many ways we can use technology. There are ways that, in some cases, they're used for systems of efficiency and control and, if you like, the sort of panopticon model of control and authority. But in many other ways, we can look at technology for its capacity to connect us to other people, to, if you like, enable us to do things together that we couldn't on our own. And in many cases, actually make the kinds of decisions collectively that we wouldn't have made if we weren't connected to those other people, that in some sense helps to perpetuate that sort of collective, that collective model of decision making. And so in a sense, what I'm arguing for is not for technologies that try and get rid of wrinkles, but technologies that are actually supporting and supported by the concept of mess, diverse inputs, diversity of participant, diversity of outcome, and all of that. And that's kind of the type of structure of participation that I'm looking for. And again, to sort of use a bit of an old metaphor, you know, where you might have originally had a sort of a very authoritarian structure of participation, which was very robust and formally rigid, but was able to withstand certain types of tremor, if you like. I think what we're starting to find now is that the structures of participation that actually persist and that can adapt to the changing conditions that we're presented with year by year are those that are flexible, that are sort of not exactly sort of rectilinearly structured. I don't want to sort of belabor that metaphor of the structures, but I think it's important to understand that it is possible to design different types or different ways of connecting people together into these sorts of participatory structures. On that note, I'm going to go through some of the projects to sort of illustrate how these have been manifested in different projects. And I can't claim that, you know, that all of the things I've just talked about feature in every single project. If anything, the projects have been a series of experiments to uncover the process through which these kinds of projects get done, if you see what I mean. So I'm talking about them somewhat chronologically, but perhaps not entirely. Just by way of starting, I wanted to show you a bit of a fun project, which was in Santa Monica in, I think, 2008, which was a project where I was basically set with this problem of, look, we're going to be doing something for one night. There's going to be 100,000 people coming. We want to make them feel as though they are part of the experience, and it's got to be big and bright and flashy and all the sorts of stuff that usually goes with something spectacular. And I'll show you some video here. So we built a cloud on the beach. So every one of these creatures flying is one person's voice emanating from the crowds. What we're basically trying to do here is give people an excuse to just let loose in public and scream. There were no instructions, there was no kind of explanation of what was going on. It was really something that people had to experiment with. And the really funny thing was that so you'd see people starting to teach each other what was going on and experiment with it and sort of pointed at and sort of explained to each other what they saw in the interaction. So what was interesting here was to look at the way that this kind of gave people an excuse to do something they were sort of accustomed to doing, and a way of using this spectacular presentation as something that brought people from afar and kind of progressively got them closer and closer to a point of interaction, if you see what I mean. And I think this was one of the first projects that made me realize that actually the point of a spectacle, apart from being spectacular, is to have a way to draw people in that didn't know about the thing and to enable them to participate or to stand on the side for a while before deciding actually to dive in, to be able to watch other people doing things before they decided to test the water themselves. And if you think of this incrementally on, you know, the old model of the fireworks, where you just sort of sit back and watch it, this is that idea of saying, okay, well, this is the spectacle that people can actually get involved in directly themselves. The Reconfigurable House was a project originally done with Adam Somley-Fisher, who, if you know Prezi, he was the founder of Prezi, the presentation tool, the Zooming presentation tool. We wrote a pamphlet, this was around 2005-ish, called Low-Tech Sensors and Actuators for Artists and Architects. And what we'd done was basically go, you get all these toys and gadgets in Chinatown, they're very cheap, sort of £1, and they're filled with sensors and actuators and things like that. And what we wanted to look at was how you could hack all of these sensors and then string them together to make far more interesting and complex interactive systems. And so we wrote a pamphlet, which was actually sponsored by FACT in Liverpool, for others to be able to build similar kind of interactive systems with very little technical skills. So you didn't know how to solder, you didn't know how to program, you didn't need to know anything, but you could start to connect these building blocks together. And this was some of our experimentation. So this was the cat. You might have seen this, you clap or you touch it and it makes noise and the eyes light up. But you can actually start taking off all of its parts and use those sensors and the eyes as actuators to start to do other stuff, to connect into monkeys and walkie-talkies and mobile phones and build up all sorts of quite interesting stuff. Or you could, so here's some of the pages from the manuscript, or you can embed them in bricks and make a touch-sensitive wall. So what we did was we thought we'd actually build out from this and build an entire reconfigurable house with all of these toys and gadgets hacked together to be inputs and outputs, sensors and actuators, but one in which we did not ourselves, as the designers of the system, configure it ourselves, but we enabled the occupants to decide what connects to what. So whether you connect a mouse to a monkey to a... So the mouse responds to movement, the monkey makes a noise, you can make a burglar alarm that way, or you could, so this was the sort of framework for the house. You see some of the cats over here, you see lilies that sort of glow, you see speaker outputs, penguins on the wall, there's monkeys over there, and you use a touch interface to sort of connect things together, so that you basically script what the house does to you. This was, in a sense, a comment on, at the time there was a lot of this talk about smart homes, and all was presented as this kind of white, sleek box, iPod-like box. Now we think of the iPod. At the time there wasn't, I don't think the iPod came out, maybe it had. But it was always thought of, the smart home was this kind of home where you as the occupant had no idea what was going on behind the wall, and if the light bulb went out, you'd have no idea how to change it. And we wanted to kind of turn that process inside out and say, what is the smart home, if you like, that you can build yourself out of all the stuff that you can buy inexpensively with very little technical skill, that you can then program through a kind of graphical interface to respond to you, and more importantly, you know, actually build on and share these kinds of programs with other people in their own reconfigurable houses. So we, I won't go through all the video right now, but we did this again in Belgium, and so the idea was to have this sort of whole network of these reconfigurable houses responding to each other. Which brings me to OpenBurble. So OpenBurble is the very first version of the thing we're going to be doing downstairs, actually here in Salford Quays. It's a little different, and I'll explain where it's different at the end, because we've done this in various cities around the world, and every time we do it, we try and do something new with the basic framework. But this is where it kind of started, which was basically designed this kind of carbon fiber module. It's quite big, 2 meters tall, with balloons, electronics inside the balloons, LEDs and sensors and things. And the idea was basically to create a kind of Lego kit where members of the public could come along and connect this up together. This was in Singapore. So out in this sort of public square, the idea was to get members of the public themselves designing a physical structure that would be lifted up into their skyline. They then inflate it themselves and they erect it into a structure. In this case, it was almost 20 stories tall. And this was something that actually changed the skyline, albeit only for one evening, but it was probably the first time that most people actually thought that they could design a fragment of their city. And so you can see here, so these balloons are quite large, they're about 3 foot across, just to give you kind of sense of scale. I think I have some better video as well. This is another version. So you can kind of get a sense of the scale of this thing here. Yeah, so the idea here was to look at people actually configuring and changing their skyline, albeit for only one night. Now, and here's a few other versions that we did, some of the photos. What we're doing in Salford is we're doing something a little bit differently, which is here the structure is actually already pre-designed. What we discovered actually is that in different implementations, people tended to end up building a rather similar structure. And so it didn't necessarily make sense to take the Lego kit always to sort of new places and say, try and surprise us this time if you like. And instead to think about something specific about the way the colors themselves would be expressed on the surface of this thing. Because again, in the Singapore version, actually when they were connecting it together, they had no idea how the colors would come out. So in Salford, actually, what we're looking at is the first step to actually having an API, if you're familiar with that term, an API for the Burble itself. And so an API in computing terms is when you have like a web app or a web service, and an API enables other people to build something using your application. So for example, if you use Twitter, Twitter has an API, which means that a computer can directly access all of the data, and another developer can build an application on top of the Twitter tweets and people and things like that. We're starting to think about here, how do you take a physical structure that you put into the city and actually open it up so that other people can start to determine what gets projected onto that surface? So, you know, often now in cities we have urban screens all around us. And the people that determine what goes onto that screen are almost always, the person who occupies that building. They decide what content gets projected. And I suppose that the BBC screen downstairs is a good example of this. They decide what goes onto that screen. And so we're interested to think about this Burble structure as a screen that's actually offered to the members of the public for them to decide what goes onto the screen. So the version that we're doing here, as I said, it's a bit of an experiment. It's a little different also from the one that you saw in Paris. In Paris, it was a very simple thing, which was that there was a set of tablets, and people would line up, and they were able to finger paint and change the patterns in real time on the surface of the verbal. And we're doing that here as well, but we're also basically connecting it to the Twitter API at the same time, so that everyone else can actually tweet to affect the colors in real time of what's going on the surface of the verbal. So there's going to be this kind of interaction between the environment that's kind of pushing around the screen, some people who have queued up to actually use the tablets and kind of draw directly on the surface, and then all the rest of the people that are actually forming the sort of crowd around the verbal that themselves will be able to tweet and directly manipulate the colors of the background and things like that, and have a sort of an interplay between different types of interaction with the verbal. So we're looking at something here that I sometimes think of as the granularity of participation, where you have sort of, ideally, although we don't in this case have three levels, but ideally there would be people who are really technically savvy, who could actually write code and generate patterns that would go onto the screen. That we don't have here yet, but that's sort of underpinning a lot of what we do. So we'd have that, and then we have people who are not that technically savvy, but they're technically savvy enough to know how to tweet and hashtag and things like that, and they can affect the surface of the or the projections on the surface. And then there's people perhaps who don't have that much technical knowledge at all, who can actually directly manipulate it using just the touch surface of the screen. And just trying to think always through projects of how do you enable these sorts of this multi-layering of participation. So it's a bit of an experiment in a sense. 98% of it we've already proven works, and there's a sort of 2% that is, you know, sort of it's the kind of interesting bit to see what do people do, how do people tweet, and how do they tweet it? We'll see how it goes. Assemblance was a project that we did at a Barbican, actually about a year ago, but it's now on tour for, I think, 3 years or something around the world. Currently in Sweden, next going to Greece? Yes, Athens. It's budget clear and everything. Okay. So this project actually started because we did a whole bunch of projects, none of which I'm showing now, but we did a whole bunch of projects with lasers. And we became really fascinated about the use of light as a physical structure, as a physical medium for manipulating. And here you can see me sort of actually, one of our experiments, which was a set of laser beams that responded to three-dimensional movement, in other words, responding to gesture, and I'd basically taken all these laser beams and gathered them in my arms. And we started thinking about this as a way of experimenting with designing and building almost like a virtual reality, but made physical. You know, often when you think about virtual reality, you've got a headset on and you've got sort of computerized images, but with this kind of system that we started experimenting with, you could actually literally draw things with your hands around you. And so we ended up making this project called Assemblance, which was basically a kind of a, we thought of it almost as a kind of a playground for experimenting in the structures of participation of the engaged city, if you like, rather than the smart city. So, you know, we learn a lot of our social skills in the playground when we're young. We learn how to interact with other people, and we learn how to agree or disagree or resolve conflict or what have you. And then when we're older, we no longer feel like we need to learn that. But the way our cities are changing these days, you know, changing so quickly, and the technologies through which we interact with each other are changing so quickly, that we wondered whether there was a need for a new kind of playground in which people could experiment in these new ways of interacting with each other. And so we kind of built this shared, I can't call it a virtual reality because it's actually there in front of people, but a shared environment in which everyone could use their gestures to draw these structures around them. And you'll see in some cases, you know, they're very delicate and sort of fibrous. And in other cases, you could literally go like this and draw, in fact, I think I've got some video here, and draw a wall around you. And the idea is that the structures that you build on your own are actually quite delicate. So you have to be really careful in drawing the walls around you. And if you move too quickly, you shatter the light structure that you've just created. But if you draw things in collaboration with other people, for example, if you're holding hands with other people while you draw these things, those structures become much more resilient and robust, and you can actually knock them out of the way and they'll just bounce back. And you'll see hopefully some video where actually these things actually respond as if they're gravity, and they, you can sort of kick them back and so forth. So here's somebody sort of hitting one with their hands. And so it's a way of sort of encouraging, enabling people to build stuff on their own, but encouraging them to work together to build stuff, because that would be the kind of structure that lasts longer. So Doc became a particular expert here and could actually draw with two hands, as you just saw. Jumping, okay, so the stuff I've showed you so far, and how are we doing for time?
I think we're good.
Okay. The stuff I've shown you so far has been on the sort of the end of the spectrum that I refer to as citizen engagement spectacles. It's stuff that, in most cases, ordinary people use to interact with each other in some way and ideally kind of connect to each other. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the stuff that happens on what I call the other end of the spectrum, although I see them all as part of the same thing, which is the Internet of Things and this sort of more technical end of stuff, if you like. Patchway was a platform that I launched going on sort of 7-8 years ago now, back in 2007-ish. And this was before anyone was really talking about the Internet of Things, and I definitely wasn't thinking about the Internet of Things myself. What I was thinking about was a way to enable people to share data in real time between devices and sensors and buildings and environments and things like that. And it basically came out of, do you remember the reconfigurable house project where we had these sorts of open smart homes? And we just thought it'd be interesting to be able to connect all of these up in real time, especially because we started having exhibitions and installations and projects around the world happening at the same time. And we wanted some easy way to remotely monitor what was going on. And so actually in about 2004-5-ish, I built a sort of very simple way to just take sensor data and turn it into a bit of JavaScript that would represent some data in real time on a web page. And what I discovered was that friends and colleagues and other sorts of artists and architects wanted to use the same system to connect up their projects, their buildings, Arduinos, their sensors, and start to make that data available to others to build on at the same time. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew until I launched as a platform called patchbay.com, patchbay being the idea of a thing where you can patch anything into anything else. And at its peak in 2011, there were thousands and thousands of people around the world sharing data in real time, from radiation monitors, air quality monitors, energy monitors, from cars and ships and weather stations and seismographs and soil sensors, and all of this stuff being shared in real time. I think on some days there were about 100 million data points going through the system every day. It was kind of it was known at the time a little bit like Twitter for sensors. And I'm going to just actually talk about one specific thing, which is what we saw happening in Japan following the radiation crisis after the disaster at Fukushima, which was that the citizens were very concerned, of course, by the levels of radiation and wanted to make sense of what was going on. And the government was not able to release data quickly enough. And so there was this demand for radiation information. And what we discovered was that the Japanese community on Patch Bay was basically connecting up radiation monitors, Geiger counters and things to the system, sharing that data in real time, and also building tutorials for other people to connect up their radiation monitors. And within a couple of weeks, there were suddenly a couple of thousand feeds across the country, some of which were updating once per second, where the government had been struggling just to get data out once per week or even once per day. And so there was this kind of big outpouring of people just measuring what was going on. Now, what was interesting was that at the time, there was a bit of a reaction by the sort of radiation specialists around the world, because this became a bit of a global phenomenon, saying, you know, it's dirty data, everyone's using the different types of radiation monitor, they're using different units, they're amateurs, they don't know how to set up their radiation monitors, etc., etc. But I think they missed two very important things. First, the fact that this was all happening out in public meant that there was so much feedback to each other about mistakes that were made. The openness, the transparency of the process itself meant that there were things like, you know, we'd see on Twitter people saying, you tagged that as microsieverts, but it must be in nanogray. Or, you know, somebody else saying, looking at the sensor pattern, I bet you've got your sensor pointing downwards, not upwards. And, you know, things like that, which I thought were very interesting. So there was this kind of collective educational process that was far more empowering than it would have been if it had just been, you know, citizens waiting for the data just to arrive from the government. And secondly, the thing I think that they were missing was the fact that this situation was simply an attempt by citizens to try and make sense collectively and do something active towards the problem, not to feel like passive entities just waiting to be told what to do. And actually, they weren't interested in this idea of objective data. They were only interested in, does that number go up or does it go down? And how does it compare to my neighbor? Or how does it compare to the neighboring village? They weren't trying to amass some sort of big data set that could then be analyzed by experts. They were only concerned by what was going on near and around them. But what happened next, I think, was the most interesting thing, which is that people started to do stuff with that data. So Haiyan Zhang actually built this kind of interface for visualizing the radiation values and comparing to pre-disaster levels, and also discussing the health effects, because nobody else had done this before, which is kind of incredible in retrospect. But you know that radiation, the danger does not necessarily come just from the level, it comes from how long you're exposed to it. In other words, you can be exposed to very high radiation for a short period of time, or you can be exposed to low levels of radiation for a long period of time that are actually quite damaging. And this, so her interface enabled you to make sense of that for the first time. There were other visualization tools for looking at where the hotspots currently were, or to look at the trends over time to kind of fly through visualization of the radiation effects. The Winds of Fukushima Android app took wind direction, wind speed, and radiation data and combined it to predict where the radiation would peak next, and so on and so forth. There were dozens of other things. There was if you didn't have a Geiger counter that could be connected to the web, somebody built this kind of form where you could just type in the values directly. If you didn't have a radiation monitor but your neighbor did, you could put an SMS alert onto their radiation monitor and be alerted when the value exceeded a certain amount, and so on and so forth. This was the important thing to understand here is that this was a means of expression, a means of actually acting upon the world and sort of being able to talk knowledgeably about it, which would not have been possible if it were solely a process of making data public. This is why I often come back to this idea that it's not enough to make data public. Actually, you have to get the public making the data. That is the process through which people really start to learn about, and more importantly, be able to act upon their environment. And I'm going to just go through two last things. One is, on the same note, is thinful.net. Which is something that we launched about 18 months ago. So now that there are now thousands of things like Patchbay was back in the day, there are lots and lots of different data infrastructures. If you have a sensor and you want to get it online, you have a choice of many different ways to do that. And what we realized was actually this is, the situation is rather similar to the early days of the web. In other words, if you're interested in air quality and you want to know where the local air quality monitor is on your street, you don't know whether to go to AQICN network or the Air Quality Egg network or perhaps your local government's air quality network, because they're all on their own infrastructures. They're all on their own systems. They're basically all siloed in separate kind of web services. And what we realized was that this was very similar to the early days of the web, where when you got online, you did it through your academic institute, or you did it through Prodigy, or Daemon, or CompuServe, or what have you. And actually, there was no visibility to what was going on beyond the boundaries of your kind of the garden of the internet that you were in, until along came the search engines that enabled you to find stuff that was going on beyond your own particular network. So basically what we did is we built a search engine for the Internet of Things that goes out and crawls every data infrastructure that we can find and reveals to you the sorts of things that you might be interested in. So for example, if you say something like, what is the air quality in Manhattan? Then it'll show you a bunch of air qualities sensors that are each on different networks. So on the Air Quality Egg network or on the AQICN network. And you can follow this through and find the original data source for that device itself to actually get the up-to-date information. We're not aggregating all this data. We're just pointing it where you can go and find it. Or you might say something like, what's near me right now? And we can see how this comes up here. So does that look about right?
Yeah.
And we have, okay, there's a Raspberry Pi over there. We have what looks like a building management system of some sort. We have an iBeacon, another iBeacon, and another Raspberry Pi. Do you know anything about this? And so you can start to get some kind of visibility on the connected devices in and around your city. So there's often this question that's asked, you know, when is the Internet of Things coming? Or when are we going to be able to do something with it? And what we like to say with this is that it's already here. There's already masses and masses of data that's already public that people or companies already chosen to make public because they want other people to find that data. But it's just so hard to find because it's on different networks and you don't know where it is. So our kind of remit is basically to try and open that process up and make it easier to discover. There is another sort of track of stuff, which I won't go into very deep right now, but the question in the Internet of Things is, you know, when you have personal, private data, how do you determine who has access to that data, if anybody at all? And so actually, along with the kind of discoverability of open data that you can see here, we're also working on the other end of this question, which is that how do you structure the entitlement to access that data or even be found in something like this? Because, you know, one of the kind of goals, one of the things that people generally agree on about the Internet of Things is it'd be great if all this stuff could somehow talk to each other, right? That your car and your home and your neighbor's weather station and what have you, were in some way able to share data. But of course, all of that data is so personal and private and valuable, and we don't actually trust others to make use of it. So if I have a heart monitor, I might want my doctor to have real-time, high-resolution heart data immediately. But I want my mother to have access to it, but delayed by a week, so I don't freak her out. I might make it available to a research study, but I want it anonymized. And then I'll sell it to a pharmaceutical company because they're actually paying me for it. But again, perhaps I want it aggregated or something. And so for each of these, I need to be able to structure what we call the entitlement to access that data, which has to go hand in hand with the discovery. Now, the key is, not to get too technical about it, but the key is how do you build this kind of trust network where none of the parties trust each other. And what's really interesting is that cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and things like that, have been using the technique, a technical strategy known as the blockchain, for creating trustless, distributed systems for exchanging information. And so we're basically looking and building for that kind of thing. Essentially, a distributed, trustless mechanism for sharing data where none of the data actually has to pass through any single central authority.
With the government now not very keen on encryption, has any thought been put into that at all?
There's been a thought put into it. You mean by us?
Yeah, and obviously not.
Yeah, thought put, I can't say that we have a particular strategy for dealing with legislation that might prohibit encryption. I definitely have a strong opinion on it, but we're pushing ahead with this regardless.
Well, I just have a quick question,
yes.
Robert, just for Josie. Can I just make sure, have we still got time for questions and things? Great, fantastic.
Yeah, and I was just going to wrap up with some of the key lessons. First, specifically on data-driven participation. Some of the ways we tend to now structure projects around data-driven participation is actually not to ask about problems, but ask about dilemmas. And this means that, you know, for example, when you're doing something around air quality, often, you know, the framework of discussion will be, okay, there's this problem with air quality and cars cause air, cause pollution, and therefore how can we use data to change? Actually, most people who are driving are doing that for what they consider to be very logical reasons, right? It might be speed or it might be their concerns for safety or what have you. And their requirements just conflict with the requirements of cyclists and pedestrians and school children, what have you. And the question actually is, how do you identify first those dilemmas, where those sorts of goals clash? So who actually experiences those dilemmas becomes the next question. Where do they clash? And how do you actually look at how the kind of conflict areas come to pass? So for example, you know, this is kind of in the context of having been to one too many air quality events that were all about, oh, let's measure air quality and then we'll produce maps of the air quality across the city and then people will be able to walk to work along a nice route that has, you know, better air quality, which actually doesn't change the air quality problem at all. And so, yeah, I forgot to say that at the beginning. That's kind of where this comes from. How can you start to resolve some of these dilemmas by actually coupling them to incentives? In some cases, the incentives actually match for the two parties that have dilemmas that seem to be in conflict. But even having done all of this, it really comes down to the question of what kind of evidence is needed to demonstrate that those kinds of incentives are going to result in the kind of resolution of the dilemma that has been identified earlier. What are the tools then for amassing that evidence? And really what this all becomes about is how do you actually build those tools to enable members of a community or members of a kind of interested parties to build the tools for amassing their own evidence to convince themselves that the incentives for resolving the dilemmas between them and other stakeholders are actually possible, rather than just, you know, starting again from the perspective, oh, there's a problem and we're going to solve it. And then more sort of generally, just in terms of sort of structures of participation, I think one of the things that we've realized is that you can't just sort of paint a pretty picture and think that the end goal is somehow going to convince everyone to join in. This was actually the classic problem with community design in the urban environment, I think in the 70s, where you'd sort of build a beautiful picture that said, you know, if everyone did this, and if everyone painted their houses like this, and if everyone walked down the street in this way and cleaned up after themselves, look what a lovely picture, look what a lovely neighborhood we'd have. Of course, everyone says, well, if I do all that work, I know that my neighbor isn't going to, so why should I, and, you know, just sort of collapses. So then the question is, actually, how do you design a system or design a sort of a proposition so that actually you don't need everyone to agree from the start. What are the what is the minimal incremental incentivization that you can provide to get people to join into something that doesn't require everyone to say, okay, we're all on the same page now. There's making data public, and there's also public making data, as I said earlier. This is kind of related as well. You know, the idea that rather than trying to identify these sorts of individual problems, try and actually find where two different domains benefit each other somehow. And the public spectacle, as I mentioned, you know, it doesn't require any kind of long-term spectacle, but it does kind of encourage people to get incrementally closer to some kind of deeper engagement and participation. And finally, this is probably the most important one for me. When you're dealing with the kind of mess of the city and you're dealing with the mess of participation, sometimes the proposition that emerges will be so complex that it cannot even be explained by a single person. And I just wanted to show a shot of the output of a workshop that I did in Pakistan a few years back with some urban designers, architects, and sociologists, a proposition for a neighborhood in Karachi that had issues of rubbish in the streets, noise from the buses honking, shopkeepers unable to market their goods because the noise was too high, and so people wouldn't actually be able to hear them because, of course, all the shops are open. People not going up onto the pavement because it was littered, filled with rubbish. And we basically came up with this proposition where every participant knew how their individual decisions affected their nearest neighbor. And we then went out and performed this for a day on this street in Karachi. And it was a sort of an amazing urban performance that I just can't even explain, but it involved the sweepers, the bus drivers, the pedestrians, the shopkeepers sort of transacting in orange juice and promising not to honk and et cetera, et cetera. But it was literally too complex to even remember or understand all of the interacting parts. And so this was all that actually remained of it. Thank you.
There's kind of two parts of the presentation. There's kind of quite different methods of participation. One at the start that was kind of very playful, and then towards the end something was kind of quite practical and purposeful. Have you ever thought about trying to marry those two things together to encourage participation through play, but having a kind of a serious positive practical effect on society or environment?
Yeah, actually we're constantly, that is actually our constant challenge in me and my team, is that we know we actually enjoy all the kind of ends of the spectrum, but how do we bring them closer together? And I think that was probably done closest in a project I didn't show, but it's called Linguini in Bradford, where originally I was actually asked to be commissioned to do a lighting design project for the, are you familiar with the city center? The Mirrorpool Park? And so originally it was filled with roads and things like that, and they're bringing in this park, and I was asked to do a lighting project for the new park, and ended up actually writing or basically producing an operating system for connecting up the lights, the LEDs in the floor, the lasers, fountains, mist machines, weather station, cameras, to control and configure all these, a little bit like the reconfigurable house, but on a kind of city scale. And the original idea was actually that this makes it easier for the council to re-script the way all these parks respond to people. And of course we delivered a lighting piece built on top of that. But actually the longer term goal, and we're hoping to be able to actually complete this sort of phase 2.5, 3 over the next year, was actually to then open it up so that first of all local designers and technologists could start to re-script on top of that operating system. You know, hopefully playful and interesting interactions, but more importantly, the following stage would be actually opening it up so that then non-technical people could also start to reconfigure in situ how the park responded to them. So that probably got to the closest of marrying a sort of quite technical infrastructure with actually opening it up in such a way that actually people can play with the way the space responds to them, basically.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's quite a big question, but where do you and your team start? What's your general process when you get a project?
That's an interesting question. I'd like to say that we do have a sort of formal methodology. We don't exactly. I suppose that we always have inklings of ideas that are just floating around. But it isn't until we actually have some kind of agreement to work somewhere specific that things start to gel into a kind of a, some kind of coalescence of some kind of themes or what have you. And usually that's done in conversation with either the commissioning entity or the local council or some community organization that's invited us. But what we try and do is not actually fix the project goals at the beginning of the project, which is an important thing. I mean, there are certain goals that, yes, we are probably core to the project, which might be to do with engagement particular community or something like that. But it's important not to make a formal proposition for a project and then simply deliver on it. Instead, to kind of, basically what we try and do, the ideal situation is that we start with a kind of a core group of people in the community that are concerned about something, and through a series of exercises, basically try and figure out at least a starting point for the project goal, and as the outcome of that process, to also decide who should come to the next meeting, which should not be the same people. Or it could be people that are related to or that have a counterpoint or what have you. Those people then, in collaboration, we try and morph the project goal a little bit more, and then again identify who comes to the next meeting, and to the next one, and hopefully we're building up a sort of a bigger group of kind of, and hopefully a diverse group, hopefully, that has in some way affected not just, hasn't just affected the outcome, but has affected the purpose of the outcome, which in some senses is the more important part. So that's a bit of a methodology.
I'm a theatre maker on no budget, so a lot of this. But what I was interested in is, have you any experience of using these sorts of ideas of participation in creating narrative and having audiences affect, because you obviously have them affect the things that you're presenting, the narrative structure?
I haven't specifically, I don't know if Andrew has. Andrew is also from the team, and he's actually done a lot of stuff specifically in theatre.
I have. There's lots of companies out there there are a number of companies out there that have. My background is a theatre producer, that's where I started. And I kind of moved into using technology within performance, particularly kind of more dance as well as more kind of experimental stuff before I got into it.
But is there experience of using audience participation to affect the
performance? Yeah, absolutely. There's loads of examples.
I saw a beautiful example in Medellin in Colombia when I was there, and what it was, there was a festival that was, I'm trying to remember what they were called, Fractal. And what they usually did was they would invite a science fiction author to, in a sort of community setting, co-curate and co-create a science fiction story about a shared memory of a possible future for that location, which was a bit sort of technological, but it was working with people that were not focused on technology, if you like. But what they did in this one instance, which I thought was really beautiful, was, in fact, I think they'd invited Bruce Sterling, who couldn't come that year, and they ended up actually getting a local songwriter of cumbias, which is the local sort of dance, to come. And in collaboration with the community, wrote songs about the future that they wanted to bring into their into their neighborhoods, and then they danced to the songs that they'd written about their future. And it seemed quite a lovely way to sort of incorporate, if you like, the imagination, or the kind of designed imagination for a future.